0818-715-815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And Joe at RT.ie, Michael O'Sullivan contacted us separately to Brendan Colvert, separately to Anne Kelly, but they all are coming up with the same idea. Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You're in Cork. Now, you lived in a trailer park in the States. Would you describe what a trailer park is and what it's like living in one?
Okay, no problem. In the 70s, I was in the USA, Philadelphia, you know, J-1 visa, student visa. And my cousin was going to Temple University, and he lived in Ardmore, that's in West Philly, big massive trailer park. And it seemed to be all students. And the way they work was, there was a notice board, you see trailers for sale.
Okay.
You pick one, you buy one, you go down, you live in it, and then you paid rent and a small bit of money for water and services. And I just double-checked with the cousin, and he set me on something interesting. There's 16 million Americans live permanently, that's the key phrase,
wow,
permanently in trailer parks.
By choice,
the whole USA.
By choice, Michael.
By choice, yeah, because it's a very cheap way to live.
Okay, well,
you
lived in one, you tell me what it's like.
Oh, it was fine. You get the L out, the elevated train, you get off, you walk about half a mile, you were there. Now, there were in the 70s, they were still strict. You had to show ID going in. There was no messers allowed in, you know.
Okay.
And you lived in a three-bedroom trailer. I was working security 50 hours a week. I had plenty of money because the rent was cheap, you know. All the students do it there for 3 or 4 years while they're in college, and then they usually sell on the trailer to somebody else and move away. You don't own the ground. You're only renting the pitch, you know.
And what are the facilities like?
Facilities in our trailer was, okay, you have a choice. You can pay the A classification where they hook you up to water and power and all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was in, the student one, they were hooked up to the power and they had a chemical toilet. It was a bit awkward because you had to kind of, you know, wheel it, this kind of wheelie thing and all that. But it was dirt cheap, like. But if you wanted to pay the bit extra, you had the same as you get anywhere in Ireland. And Ireland is full of seasonal mobile home parks, but you have to get out for 6 months of the year, 5 or 6 months, and you get the same facilities in America.
In fairness, they've all just reopened on Patrick's weekend. That's when they reopened, isn't it?
Yeah,
well,
they were closed for 5 months in the winter,
yeah.
And I mean, I gave it up because, you know, it was no use to me. In the winter, I wanted to go down the seaside. I couldn't, you know, so I gave it up.
Yeah, but is that not a hint that the weather in the States is very different to the weather here?
Well, the funny thing about it is that my cousin's ex-girlfriend is now living in Nome in Alaska, and she's living in a trailer home. I mean, it's like modern housing in America is basically timber and cladding, you know? They don't use blocks like we do, so they use massive insulation. All they've done is brought that insulation into the trailer parks.
Okay, now, I've looked up this, you know, the grant that people can now get if they give their home. It's 800 euro a month. By the way, it's 800 euro a month, but the granting authority, i.e. the government, are willing to look at additional costs if you have additional costs. Now, they say it must be available for at least 6 months. Now, I don't know if you looked them up. Do they eliminate mobile homes from, if I said I'd give my mobile home in Wexford, wherever people have them, I'd give it for 800 quid a month for 6 months. That's 4.5 grand. I don't know what the management fees are now in mobile homes. Remember, mobile homes don't pay property tax. They're exempt. They pay a management fee, but that covers your water, your refuse, and on a lot of occasions, it covers your electricity as well. So 800 quid a month for your mobile home in Wexford, especially given the weather's now, and it is the sunny southeast, given that the weather's improving, children, some incredible schools in Wexford, especially around Gowrie, Tara Hill, those areas. I just wonder, would they accept a mobile home as an offer for housing Ukrainian refugees?
Well, I wasn't even thinking of Ukrainian refugees, and truthfully, I wasn't even thinking of the present housing emergency in Ireland. I was looking at a very tight little strata of people which has worked for 30 or 40 years plus. to take care of, let's say, students, people doing apprenticeships, people going to technical schools and everything. The young generation in their late teens, early 20s, that needs summer cheap until they get on their feet in a job and settled, you know?
Okay, and they now, say the main thing in the, if you look up gov.ie, housing standard for accommodation recognition payment scheme, which is a scheme, 800 quid a month, administered by the Department of Children, Equality, Disability, Integration and Youth. They talk about structural conditions. Now, the main thing they talk about is safety. And there's one thing you can say about mobile homes, Michael, and trailers. They are safe because you can get out. One, they're all on the ground level. So there isn't far to, if you get out a window, anyone can get out. Your granny or granddad can get out the window, God forbid. Two, they usually have a main door, a double door, because they open onto a deck or whatever. So the chances of getting out of them quickly are very much better than a house, much better than a house. Yeah. Now, they do say, and this is where a good state of repair, which most mobile homes are beautiful, beautifully kept.
I agree.
Roof, windows, floor, ceilings, bear with me, floor, ceilings, walls, stairs. Well, there's no stairs in the bungalow either. Doors, fascia, tiles, gutter, downpipes, fittings, furnishings, gardens are common areas, maintained in good condition and repair. I think you can say that about any trailer park in Ireland. The common areas are really well kept, really well kept. Where a window has an opening section, Michael, where through which a person may fall, and the bottom of the opening section is more than 1,400 millimetres above external ground level. Sure, most mobile homes are three steps away from the ground, aren't they?
But if I could just say, Joe, like, I mean, while I was talking to Carrie, your researcher, and I was only talking about my American experience, I checked on our nearest neighbour, the English.
Okay.
And at the moment, according to the British government thing, there's 300,000 people live in permanent mobile parks, they call them, right? Now, and the key in England is they changed all their legislation in 2013 and they made it ultra strict. And it's all to do with fit person. I mean, to get into a mobile home park in England, you have to have no criminal record. You have to be checked out. No civil, you know, very, very strict. The whole idea is that they're oasis of kind of peace and quiet for people.
Yeah,
they do focus on the over 55s, you know, I will admit that. But what I then went and checked on the Irish legislation. Now, they have created an encyclopedia of information and documentation, the whole lot. And I was just looking, zero on mobile homes, zero on this. But I will say, lately now, they ran roughshod through all the legislation and they eliminated environmental guidelines, environmental restrictions, and they're building modular homes. Now, the reason I know this is that I'm living here in Blackrock and just down the road in Mahon, lovely neighbourhood, at the back of an old industrial site, they're putting in about 60 modular houses, you know? Mm-hmm. Now, there's a bit of security around there, but you might let me have a look around. Lovely, lovely. But I mean, the minimum cost for one of them is about 140,000. I can buy half a dozen trailers down the road here, secondhand, between 4,000 and 5,000. You know.
Okay, I'm just wondering, has anyone applied to offer a mobile home to the state for €800 a month? They also say adequate cooking facilities, including an oven. Well, an oven these days. Well, a lot of them have ovens, but an oven these days is your air fryer. Isn't it? That's an oven.
Perfect.
They're very
big,
yes. Suitable facilities for the effective and safe removal of fumes. That's straightforward. There's about 15 windows in a mobile home. A fridge or a fridge freezer. That's a given. A sink. That's a given, isn't it?
I mean, I lived in them quite happily for 6 months and I had everything I needed there.
Okay.
Perfect, nice and warm. Cooking facilities.
And Kelly, stay there. Joe at rt.ie, 51551. Have you offered your mobile home to the state for 800 quid enough? Tell us, Anne Kelly, you say you're baffled that no one has come up with the idea. Well, yourself, Brendan, who's next, and Michael, contacted Joe at rt.ie and you have come up with the idea. Tell us. You like the idea.
Good afternoon, Joe. Yes, well, last May, I was lucky enough to be invited down to a mobile home complex in the sunny southeast. Now, it was my first time staying in a mobile home. And to be quite frank with you, I was shocked. It was three bedrooms, one bedroom a double, two bedrooms that were twin bedded, an ensuite, a bathroom, a kitchen come dining area, and a sitting room area. Outside was a decking area, a small garden, space for an outdoor garden shed for storage, and car parking facilities.
Okay, great.
And
was that your first?
It had gas fired central heating, great. Wi-Fi. It had everything you could wish for in, we'll say, a regular home. And I inquired. It was also very well laid out. It was like streets of bungalows, if you can imagine that. Because of course they're all just one story high. Gardens are all well maintained. They had a play area for children, all that sort of thing. And the cost of I said that I would very happily live in one of those, because it was, he had more than adequate space, everything built in, they come complete, and the approximate cost of a new one is €60,000.
Okay, that's how good
and
they are.
What
yeah.
I felt was that.
And how much per year to pay to keep them there?
The
water
management
and electricity.
Fee per annum is €3,300. Okay. Which works out at approximately €65 a week,
but that
or
covers your,
€300.
Does that cover your
month.
Water, your electricity, your the grass being cut in the communal
the
areas,
place, the
your
whole,
rubbish?
The maintenance of the whole complex.
Great.
Now, I appreciate these are a tourist thing, so they actually close after the October bank holiday weekend. So they're closed November, December, January, February, and you can only use it again from March. But that's
why,
because it's a holiday setup.
Yeah, I just wonder why. Okay, stay with us, Joe at rt.ie, 51551, and at 2 o'clock we'll be bringing you the results. I'm going to come back to you, and I'm going to come back to you after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We will go to Murrayfield, not for rugby, for the announcement of the who will effectively be the new First Minister in Scotland, the new leader of the Scottish National Party. It has implications for here. It has implications for the UK. But anyway, as soon as that happens, we will switch over and you can hear the results. It's between three people, as you know, Kate Forbes, Ash Regan and Humza Yousaf. And basically it's between Kay Forbes and Humza Yousaf, with Yousaf in the last few days becoming the favourite, but Kate Forbes was the early front runner. But let's see, it seems to be very tight. Brendan Colvert. Brendan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You have this idea as well, mobile homes, trailer parks. Why?
It's been on my mind for a long time. I advocated it back as far as August 2017. Brought it to the attention of various people who have the ability to make it happen.
Okay.
And I got rejection everywhere, particularly from ministers for housing. They were the ones that were the fly in the ointment.
Oh, so you already have suggested it. You've written to departments and ministers and politicians. And did you get any reply?
Enthusiasm. And then when it gets to the desk of the minister, all of a sudden there's a change of attitude.
And what is the change?
My purpose would be to take the pressure off the market by putting people in suitable, comfortable homes.
Temporarily,
and being mobile, they can be changed to any place that would be a crisis, anywhere there might be a crisis. And
but the thing
it means that the children would have fairness and so on.
Yeah, but in fairness, Brendan, I have some experience of mobile homes in Ireland, and one thing they are not is mobile. They have wheels on them, but you couldn't pull them along the back of a Ford Ranger. They're not mobile.
If it's government policy, they can always make sure.
Now, just tell me what
the product that they want.
Okay, tell me what was the reaction, because you've written about this to government ministers and politicians. What reaction did you get? Did you get any detailed response?
Well, I got promises of cooperation and further investigation. It never happened. At one stage when Minister Moriku was Minister for Housing, three people died of exposure in the winter time within sight of the iron, and that didn't change his attitude.
But I'm saying, of all the people you wrote to and all the letters you sent, did you get any replies that were in detail explaining why the idea would not run?
Well, it was usually a kick to touch. Okay. But one particular person said that the green areas in Ireland have to be preserved. I recollect a time during the 39 to 45 emergency, I walked down Chesterfield Avenue, and on both sides of the road, there were big banks of turf to try and provide heat for people in Dublin. Only a temporary measure. You look at Phoenix Park today, it's a beautiful place. You can always change the areas you employ for temporary housing in mobile homes. There's no problem with that.
But you didn't get anyone saying we are going to set up or ask a specific committee to investigate it.
I'm in despair. It never happened.
And why do you think they'd be a good idea?
Well, everybody knows there's pressure on housing.
Yeah, we know that.
The
demand is much higher than
we're capable of providing.
Well, I'll put it this way, Brendan. Would you live in a mobile home?
I lived in a mobile home in the boroughs in Rosslare for a holiday on two occasions.
But it was a delightful experience. But it was a holiday.
Was a holiday in the holiday season. But from the point of view of insulation and so on, all of these things can easily be overcome.
Absolutely.
Office of Public Works is well capable of making them comfortable for residents. No trouble.
Okay, Michael is still there, Anne is still there, Brendan is still there. Paul Newsom. Paul, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe?
Good. Your point, please.
Well, I mean, already there are hundreds of thousands of vacant concrete buildings around the country, which could be, you could use the same money that they want to hand to trailer parks or trailer trash parks. The government could use the same money to actually.
Why do you call them trailer trash parks?
Because that's how they're referred to in America.
No, that's how
they live in trailers.
No. That's how the people who, in some quarters, in some movies, that's how the people who live in them are referred to, which is very unfair.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
The people aren't trash. Stop it.
I know they're not, but the people who are living in them in America are referred to as trailer trash.
By who?
No.
In movies or whatever.
Anyway, it's common knowledge. It's in movies.
Keep going, Paul, yeah.
And that's one thing. I mean, you can travel. You talk about empty buildings. 1,000 yards from Croke Park in Dublin, there's a vacant Celtic Tiger unfinished apartment block that's still lying there with a rusted scaffolding around it.
Okay.
Hundreds of thousands of vacant buildings around the country, and they want a house. I lived in a luxurious caravan in the Yorkshire Dales for 8 months, and my memory of it is damp clothes, steam, cold, no room to put anything.
And when was that, Paul?
That was in the 70s.
The early 80s. Have you been in any mobile homes in Corktown or Ballymoney or Tramore recently?
I've had no calls to be in any of them, Joe.
There's loads of people.
Have you spent the winter?
I'm not making the suggestion. You're the one. It's 50 years.
Well, you're asking me.
I'm asking. You're saying no. Yeah, but I'm doing the questioning here. If you want to present Liveline, apply to D Forbes, and you can. I'm sure you have as much chance of getting as I have. Now it's 50 years.
Well, if they're going to pay me, you certainly have a go at it, Joe.
Yeah, 50 years since you. Since you lived in a mobile home, but they have changed since then.
It wasn't a mobile home, but it was a large caravan, John.
That's the difference. Oh, you didn't say that.
A luxurious caravan at that, because it was owned by Mercedes.
Okay, Michael.
It wasn't a nice experience.
Michael.
Joe, I did kind of, after talking to researcher Clara, I'm retired now, so I use my brain. The problem in Ireland is that when they were doing the latest document, which is Housing for All 2030, and they went through the whole lot, that was done by the Attorney General's Department. This is all Irish Times. And basically, the document they've produced is fantastic. I mean, they have made huge amounts of stuff, which I haven't even read. I just checked on one thing. They completely ignored the whole concept of using mobile homes as living space on a temporary basis. And the thing is, there's nothing in there for that. They've completely bypassed it. I would suggest, if anybody is listening, that the key legislation they want to look at is the 2013 UK Government Mobile Home Act. They have consolidated 20 years of hard-learned experience. They've created a whole strict thing, how to live quietly and safely in mobile home parks. They have a different name for them, but it's basically a mobile home park, and it's a huge success. 300,000 people in England have transferred from inner city living to living outside. I would suggest now that I know I'm talking about, I mean, I've stayed in mobile homes and everywhere, but like the problem is, you're better off, I'm actually kind of radical to a certain extent, but I'm only copying the American experience. You want to live in a mobile home trailer near a city, where you have education, facilities, and work. I would be suggesting that you find a place in Dublin just as far as the line goes.
Okay, let me bring Maya Prunty in. Maya.
Hello, Joe.
Your contribution, please.
Yeah, well, my experience was when the Kosovar people arrived in Ireland in 1999, I think it was.
Okay.
And the old artillery barracks in Kildare had been closed in 1998.
Okay.
And the government made a big mobile home park in the old artillery barracks.
Okay. And how did that work out?
Several families of Cosbars moved into those mobile homes. I was the principal in the VEC school at the time, and we had quite a number of young people in school from there, and I visited that mobile home park.
Stay with us, Maya. I just want to go over to this press conference as the new SNP leader is set to be announced.
And I am the SNP business convener, and I'm delighted to be here today at the culmination of this election contest to choose our new SNP leader. The contest has taken our three candidates the length and breadth of Scotland. They've beamed into our living rooms via TV debates, and they've worked tirelessly to engage with members all over the country. So this is a historic moment for the SNP. And as we look forward to our new leader, I want to thank Nicola Sturgeon for her exceptional leadership over the past 8.5 years. I'd also like to convey my thanks to the candidates, to our members, and to everyone at SNP HQ and our National Executive Committee who've worked so hard behind the scenes to deliver this important exercise in party democracy. And I'm delighted to welcome to the stage to announce our new leader, Lorna Finn, SNP National Secretary.
By the way, Nicola Sturgeon doesn't seem to be there, but anyway, go ahead.
As National Secretary of the SNP, I have been given the results of the party leader election 2023 from My Voice, the ballot services company. These are as follows. The final number of eligible members was 72,169. A total of 50,494 ballot papers containing a valid vote were received. There were 3 rejected postal ballot papers. The turnout was therefore 70%. 48,645 of the ballots were cast electronically, and 1,849 of the ballots were cast by post. The first preference votes are as follows. Ash Regan, 5,599. This represents 11.1% of the first preference vote. Kate Forbes, 20,559. This represents 40.7% of the first preference vote. Hamza Youssef, 24,336. This represents 48.2% of the first preference vote.
Unless they,
as no candidate received more than 50%
they go into the second round.
Ash Regan, as the candidate who received the least number of first preferences, was eliminated. And the second preference votes in favour of Kate Forbes
going to take
or Hamza
awful
Youssef
lot of,
were given to them.
Forbes
the result
to get
after
ahead
those
of
votes
Youssef
were redistributed was as follows. Kate Forbes, 23,890.
No, he hasn't.
This represents 47.9% of the final vote. Hamza Youssef, 26,032. This represents 52.1%
of the final
votes.
OK, it's a margin of about 3,000, but...
I therefore declare Hamza Yousaf duly elected as the Scottish National Party leader. Congratulations, Hamza.
He was a cabinet secretary for justice in Nicola Sturgeon's administration, a junior ministerial offices. He is very, as they, all the candidates are, as a very young man. He's 37 years of age. He's married and he has one child, and he studied in the University of Glasgow. And he is by a very, well, it's 52 to 49 ahead of Kay Forbes. And remember, Kay Forbes got into a lot of, there was a lot of talk at the start that she was going to pull out because of her controversial views. She opposed Nicola Sturgeon's gender ID agenda, as did indeed the other candidate. Indeed, Hamza Yousaf has said he will not proceed with the challenge to Westminster, who have rejected the vote in the Scottish Parliament on gender ID. He said he will not pursue it. Nicola Sturgeon was going to pursue it. He said he will not. He will not pursue it. Let's hear his voice for a few minutes.
Can I begin by paying tribute to my colleagues, both Kate and Ash? During almost 20 hustings, it's probably fell like we've seen each other more than we have our respective families. You both have put in an incredible shift, and I know that collectively we will continue to work hard as part of Team SNP. I am not just humbled of that, I most certainly am. I also feel like the luckiest man in the world to be standing here as the leader of the SNP, a party I joined almost 20 years ago and that I love so dearly. Friends, it was the late John Smith, and he got it absolutely right, when he said, "The opportunity to serve our country is all we ask." To serve my country as First Minister will be the greatest privilege and honour of my life, should Parliament decide to elect me as Scotland's next First Minister tomorrow. And just as I will lead the SNP in the interests of all party members, not just those who voted for me, so I will aim to lead Scotland in the interests of all of our citizens, whatever your political allegiance. If elected as your First Minister after tomorrow's vote in Parliament, know that I will be a First Minister for all of Scotland, that I will work every minute of every day to earn and to re-earn your respect and your trust. I will do that by treating you, the people of Scotland, with respect. There will be no empty promises or easy soundbites when the issues in front of us are difficult and complex, because government is not easy, and I won't pretend that it is. My immediate priority will be to continue to protect every Scot as far as we possibly can from the harm inflicted by the cost of living crisis, to recover and reform our NHS and other vital public services, to support our well-being economy, to improve the life chances of people right across this country. I will move quickly to develop plans to extend childcare, to improve rural housing.
Okay, there you go. And a number of things to remark, I think, quickly is that Rishi Sunak is a Hindu, isn't he? But from of Indian extraction, as is our own Taoiseach, Leo. And the new First Minister in the UK, Hamza Yousaf, is a Muslim, and he's from, his background is in South Asia. So all children, or indeed grandchildren, of immigrants to our two islands are... Now, obviously, we have a first leader, a first minister in Northern Ireland, if they could agree. And that, of course, would be Michelle O'Neill. So that's a fascinating lineup. But anyway, there you have it. Hamza Yousaf, he said, depending on the vote tomorrow, there's no issue on the vote tomorrow. The only one, the only group that might throw a fly in the ointment tomorrow, the Green Party in Scotland, who did support Nicola Sturgeon. But we wait and see. But it looks like Hamza Yousaf almost certainly is the new First Minister in Scotland. And Kate Forbes, who came a very, very, very close second, given her, she's the daughter of an evangelical minister. She expressed and spoke openly about her religion. She's stood four square against the gender politics of Nicola Sturgeon, and also stood and made a point about gay marriage, even though she said she would, well, she's no choice to support it is in legislation, but she said she opposed it originally. But anyway, that's irrelevant at this stage. Humza Yousaf is the new leader of the SNP, and by this time tomorrow will be the new First Minister in Scotland.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Back to Ireland now. Though I would remind people, all this week on BBC Radio 4, which is their main BBC radio channel, they have a whole series across every strand, from Moneybox to the Today programme to PM to the 1 o'clock to the World Tonight. They have a whole strand about the rental crisis in the UK and the homeless crisis in the UK and the building crisis in the UK and the lack of houses in the UK. So it's listen to it. It's so reminiscent of here. It is so reminiscent of here. Where's Caroline Crowley? Caroline, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Where did you live in a mobile home?
I lived in a mobile home in Pocatello, Idaho. It's in the southeast of Idaho, which is a Rocky Mountain state. And I spent a winter there from 1994 into 1995. I was in my 20s. And it was a very pleasant experience.
And all the questions that Paul Newsom was raising when he lived in them, they were damp, they were cold, damp clothes, they're second-class trailer. I don't know where the word trailer trash came in, but I'm taking it that he meant the conditions weren't great. We won't talk. I'm sure he wasn't referring to the people, but the conditions weren't great.
My experience was the complete opposite. Now, I was in my 20s. I was still in college in Ireland. So I was
okay.
I graduated. So, yeah, this was I'd immigrated and, you know, didn't have a lot of money, was in a low paying job. So I needed somewhere affordable. So this trailer park, it was a little bit on the outside of Pocatello, which is a very small city. It was more like, you know, it wasn't a caravan, it wasn't on wheels.
Okay.
These are like modular homes, and you see them being transported around America all the time. You see these large trucks on the highways, and you can see literally half a house is being transported. And that's, you know, trailer homes they're like modular. They can be just expanded like a regular home.
Okay.
But this was three bedrooms. It was owned by an elderly lady, and she rented out one room. She lived in one bedroom. I rented out one room, and there was a student in the local college who was renting the third room. Kitchen, you know, open plan kitchen, sitting room, the bathroom and the three bedrooms. You just came outside. There was parking outside of it. It snowed during the winter, so you'd have to shovel snow like everybody else. It was just like a real little kind of picket fence around it. You had your own little yard space, and really well kept, well maintained, lovely neighbourhood. You know, it was a community.
And have you seen anything like that in Ireland, Caroline?
No, I haven't. No, not at all. I mean, I rented for half my adult life, so I've rented an awful lot in Ireland as well, in the cities and rural areas, but I've never come across anything like this. The only thing we seem to have that I've seen are either, you know, summer trailer parks. And of course, you know, we have to mention our own ethnic group in Ireland that have been using caravans to live in for a long time, the Irish Travellers.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, clearly people have lived in and raised families in Ireland in, you know, trailer-like conditions. So it certainly sounds like a great suggestion coming from your listeners.
And I don't know whether you ever came across a company called Roadmaster. They seem to be, and there's another company up north as well, which do fantastic mobile homes. They're modular homes, but they're ones that go into trailer parks. Now, Roadmaster, anyone look up their website, the holiday homes they land with on site, and they land on the back of a trailer, or as they're constructed on site, they're so impressive. But they've been in Irish holiday parks for years, and they've got a very good record. I'll go back to Maya Prunty. Maya, sorry for interrupting you there with the Scottish news. But when the mobile homes were in the artillery barracks in Kildare Town in 1998, how did they get on, do you know?
Well, it seemed to work out very well. They were big enough to accommodate one family I got to know quite well. There were two parents and three children, and they were perfectly happy in their mobile home. They were refugees, so they were allowed to work, and a lot of them worked in the area.
The Ukrainians are allowed to work.
Yes,
as you know, yes. So that's your right there, yeah.
And the young people then, as they progressed through school and got part-time jobs in the afternoons and weekends, and then worked, and then I can't remember exactly how long all that went on for, but I know, I think Liz O'Donnell was the minister that was looking after that end of things at the time, and I think when everything went calm in Kosovo, they were paid, or they got some incentive to return home.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of them went back, but then many of them subsequently came back again under their own steam.
And is it still there, Maya? Is it still in?
Oh, gosh, no,
it's gone, is it? Okay.
I can't remember now, was it for 2 years maybe, or 3 years, or 1 year, until things settled down in Kosovo.
And you were the principal, did you tell us, in the VC school? And did the children come to the school, some of them?
Yes, yeah, several of the children did come to school.
And? How did that work out?
That worked out very well. But we got special hours for English classes for them, and they had no English when they came, but they fitted in very well, and they were great examples to our own children, because I remember Ramadan happened at the time of our Christmas party in school.
We're going back into Ramadan. Yeah. Sorry, I was watching a great programme yesterday on RTÉ Junior about children in school in Dublin preparing for Ramadan. But go ahead, Maya, sorry.
Yeah, but this happened, I think, the first year they were there. And our young students were amazed that here were youngsters of their own age not taking part in the party. Just spectators.
Yeah, and I was quite struck by the piece. I know Molly was the presenter, but I was very struck by the piece where all the children, only around 8 or 9, and they were asked, what were you looking forward to in Ramadan? And they were looking forward to the fasting. It was almost a sign of adulthood or whatever. I mentioned Roadmaster, another company that people are mentioning that build, they say, incredible homes, high quality, and the word mobile home probably doesn't fully explain it. But Western Homes up in Coal Island in Northern Ireland apparently make fantastic modular homes which qualify as mobile homes on a site. Therefore, they're not eligible for property tax in Ireland. Martin Kenny, I'll come to Martin after the break. Caroline, so do you think, given the image of mobile homes and trailer parks, and do you think they would be accepted in Ireland?
Well, holiday parks. They're in British Bay and in various places up in Donegal. I've seen them, and everybody who goes there seems happy with them. So I don't see why they wouldn't.
I'm still trying to find out. Maybe we'll ask the Department of Children, Health, Youth, etc. Will they consider? Obviously, they'd consider every property, but would they consider a location, a premises on a mobile home site as eligible for this approved accommodation scheme of €800 plus a month. I think we'll ask them that. Okay, Caroline, good to meet you, Margaret, Maya Prunty also, and to Paul, and to Brendan, and to Michael O'Sullivan. Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at rt.ie. Martin Kenny. Martin, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
This is an awful set of circumstances that has colluded against you and your wife and effectively your family. What happened, Martin?
Joe, on Wednesday, we had a scheduled appointment down at Wexford Hospital to the early pregnancy unit to get a scan. Mm-hmm. Ashling was 11 to 10 weeks at the time. We got the devastating news that there was no heartbeat. So we dealt with that, and Wexford were very good for being very sensitive and giving us options. The following day, Ashling started to bleed with heavy pain, cramping, and passing out of blood clots. The situation worsened where I rang the early pregnancy unit in Wexford at 1:45. I had to leave a voicemail, and they got back to me. But they said I need to present care for the closest hospital, either Hollis Street or Waterford, for the maternity unit in either or.
Just remind people of the reason why Wexford was closed.
So probably about 4 weeks at this stage, Wexford obviously had the massive fire, and the hospital is still functioning, but the emergency department is now closed, yeah, and there's a lot of beds there. So everyone, for the most part, depending on severity, people are diverted for the most part towards Waterford Hospital.
Okay.
Long story short, I had to ring the 999 and ask them I need to be brought to the Waterford Maternity Hospital. They weren't able to give me an ETA, and Ashton was bleeding heavily, so I had to make the decision to drive myself. Yeah.
Because you were scheduled for a medicinally induced, medically induced miscarriage, and medicinally induced, obviously, and you were scheduled, but in the meantime, unfortunately, your wife went into difficulty, which can be very, very, very serious. So when you rang the ambulance, what information did they say? We're under pressure because we're now in the Wexford area, we can't deliver people to Wexford A&E because it's shut down because of the fire. Therefore, we have to make an extra long journey and back again. Did they give you any reason why they seem to be exceptionally busy?
So, Joey, can you please? I didn't spend a long talking to them on the phone. I gave them information, gave them the postcode, everything ready to go, and they just told me they wouldn't have yet given me ETA and the ambulance space arrived. So, knowing that information, knowing the severity, I just had to make a decision. So, I told them I was not working, so I told them that I was told to present in what maternity ward, or okay, actually to be presented there for care. So we had to make that decision to go. So it's just from my experience before, when we'd have called an ambulance to the same area, they would have told we were there in 15 minutes. So it wasn't the same experience you had before. Again, I don't know if that's related to the hospital fire or if that's just the time of day you're in, but that's the experience we had.
So you headed to Waterford, you're in your own car. I presume you're in a panic, are you, Martin?
Absolutely. So, look, we're cool heads. Like, Ashton kind of said, look, we have to get going. And we went ourselves, and driving, I suppose you would say at a faster rate than usual. This is where the confusion starts. So, like, Wexford hand over care to Waterford. So we were told on Wednesday, look, if Ashton suffers heavy bleeding, then you need to contact the maternity ward in Waterford and let them know you're coming. So it sounds simple enough, when we heard that Wednesday. So we did that. I was just pure confusion. They didn't understand, who we were or whatever. I'm driving at speed now. I wanted to focus on the road, so I just had to end the call with them and ring Wexford's early pregnancy and ask them to make a contact on our behalf. And I guess just a lot of confusion. They rang us back saying you need to present at the back of Waterford Hospital, where someone will meet you in a wheelchair. So again, I don't know what it costs at all, so it's all just confusing information. So we're going, like, to understand the help, you understand the severity of it. Like, Ashlyn, you know, at the later stage of the journey, was passing in and out of consciousness. She wasn't, I was trying to communicate to her to make sure she was still aware of what's going on. You know, in this journey, you know, we're going to small towns. I, you know, traffic in numerous places. The worst part would have been in Waterford Keys. So, people who would have been out in the streets would have seen this. You know, again, I'm flashing lights, how the hazards aren't beaten frantically to get past. Outside the Tower Hotel, you know, I saw an ambulance that was maybe three cars in front of me stuck in traffic lights. So, picture me, I had to jump out of my car, run up to them to look for their assistance to escort us, or can they just drive with their lights on to get us to the hospital. But unfortunately, you know, I banged on the ambulance, but they didn't talk to me or they ignored me. I later found out that, you know, they're trained not to speak to anyone when they're carrying a passenger. So I assumed that was the case. So again, like, I ran back to the car outside the Tower Hotel. I just remember people there just looking shocked at what was going on. I drove on further, where I was looking off to meet a squad car, where I let down the window, asking, I need your assistance, and my wife is in a lot of pain. You know, it's an emergency situation. So they, you know, gave me an escort, which would have been about 10 minutes in traffic. It was down about two minutes. We got to the hospital then, and, you know, it was a bit of a mayhem where, you know, I got out looking for a wheelchair. You know, there was no one waiting there in the end. So I had to get assistance, get a wheelchair. I got go back to the car. Ashlyn was still unconscious, where there was one guard on one side of the door and the other one at Ashlyn's window, with numerous other their staff there trying to help as well. So, again, forgive the graphic description here, but, you know, Ashlyn got out and was put into a wheelchair where there was a lot of blood.
Woman.
We got her up to the to the delivery units in maternity, and I suppose to emphasize the severity of this, you know, Ashlyn was seen to straight away. You know, they carried out an emergency procedure by a senior obstetrician in the labour ward. You know, she wasn't given any pain relief or anything like that. That's straight to us to relieve or, you know, fix the issue. She'd lost so much blood, you know, she couldn't even get an IV into her veins. They were collapsed. That's going to her artery, I believe. Then, you know, from there, you know, we're then in a controlled manner. You know, they were very, very good. And, you know, from what she described as her pain levels of, you know, a 10, something like labour, she said, well, went down to, you know, 1 or 0. So I guess, you know, it's probably the most terrifying experience in my life anyway. But this kind of the crux of this are, one, you know, Wexford Hospital is still open, functioning, you know, the maternity ward is still open. I don't understand why a situation like this, we couldn't go to Wexford Hospital. You know, they have a labour ward, and I'm sure someone has seen this, but fine, I know that we have to work with circumstances because of the fire, and nothing we can do about that.
Yeah,
but
then
we're in an area now in outside Gowrie where, you know, we're over an hour up to the Dublin Hospital, St. Vincent's, and we're over an hour down to Waterford, and we're stuck in this kind of, you know, the problem where, you know, where do we go to? And then to be faced by the issue where the ambulance couldn't give me an ETA, it's just, I don't think it was good enough. And it just put so much stress. Like, to be brutally honest, you're like, again, I had to drive down there, and you know, I put our lives at risk by driving at such a fast rate. And lucky enough, we got there, and Ashlyn is doing great now. You know, she got the care she needed, and she's back home, she's resting.
Great.
But look, this is, it's just, I think it had to be highlighted because, you know, I haven't heard any, again, I haven't been looking either, but I haven't heard any clear information about when Wexford Hospital, the emergency departments will be opening up. I know that there's a lot of stress in Waterford at the moment from people from Wexford.
Of course, yeah. Well, I have a statement here from Wexford General Hospital, obviously apologising. They want to remind people that the emergency department will not reopen for a number of weeks. Please do not attend at this time. It will be a considerable number of weeks before the emergency department is fully open again. The reinstatement of services and the emergency department in Wexford General Hospital is the number one priority for hospital management staff. And as stated previously, the reopening of the hospital will be done on a phased basis. Once services and departments become operational, the hospital will communicate this with patients and the people of Wexford. Now, they're saying they're doing their best. I don't know how you can second guess anyone after a fire. That's the problem, isn't it? I don't know what part of the hospital that was most affected. I don't know in terms of a fire, in terms of infrastructure, with especially with fibre cables and surgery setups. I don't know how the hospital works, but I presume they're saying in good faith, we're doing our best. We're doing our best to try and get the ED department. As you know, within 3 days, within 12 hours, the Minister for Health was down there. Then there was the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar went, but I think Micheál Martin de Tánaiste was there before that. So it was regarded as a national priority, wasn't it, at the time?
Like my concern is, like, again, earlier in his pregnancy, we were down in there, pregnancy was a day after the fire, and I thought it was kind of very strange because everything was in the news about this fire. Yeah. And we went down there and we were asked if we want any scones because the minister was coming, you know, and again, I'm not going to speak on behalf of staff, but we are alluding to that. That's a typical thing our management do, to shine up, you know, the situation.
Yeah, I don't know the situation. I don't even like asking you questions given what you've gone through, and thank God Aisling is back at home. I'm awfully sorry about the miscarriage, but they're telling us we're doing our best.
Well, let's start from the start. So, like, you know, even so, we all know we have to go to Waterford now, but like the ambulance service then needs to be, you know, I would hope as possible for someone to get an ETA of when an ambulance can come. You know, obviously, if I break my arm, you know, I can wait, but our situation just couldn't wait. We had to get to it, but that's an hour and 15 minutes to get to hospital in a life threatening situation, you know. So, it's just if you can try do what's needed now to make people's lives easier for, you know, going to Waterford, or, you know, we had confusion going from handover to Wexford and Waterford, and I wonder what is it like for other people in that situation. The staff in Waterford seem to be quite confused of, you know, why did you come here in the first place? Why didn't you go to the Labour ward? These are the questions we're asked in Waterford.
Okay. And have you lodged those questions with the hospital, or is this fair enough? This is your way of doing it.
Yeah, the only thing I've done so far is, like, you know, I was in a frustrated state at the end of last week, and I kind of wrote down an email where I emailed my local TDs and Stephen Donnelly and CC'd yourselves, and this is where I'm at the moment, you know. So I guess, you know, my main priority at the moment is looking after Ashley.
Yeah, of course. Okay, Martin, I'm glad Ashley is back at home. Again, that's the second statement. It's the same statement, basically, from the HSE saying the ED department is closed. We've asked them about the pregnancy, early pregnancy unit of Wexford, and that question has to be answered. But Martin, I'm sorry you had to go through this. It's an awful time, to say the least, and condolences on the miscarriage, and I hope Aisling will be back on her feet soon. That's Martin Kennedy, just as a Gorey in County Wexford. Joe at rt.ie, 51551 is the text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715
815. And Joe at rt.ie. Anna McKenna and Drogheda, Niall Cairns and Drogheda, I presume you contacted us separately. Anna McKenna, why do you want Drogheda designated as a city? What difference would it make?
It'd make a big difference, Joe, from the point of view of administration. Drogheda, the heart of the problem is that there's not even one senior local government official permanently based in Drogheda, and it's Ireland's largest town. Nearby Eastmeath, with adjoining Drogheda South, is managed by Meath County Council in Navan, while Drogheda and South Louth is managed by Louth County Council based in the smaller town of Dundalk. So Drogheda is sitting in between two administrations, and we're falling in the middle. We're like the Cinderella city, or the invisible city coming.
But we feel that the evidence we have confirms that
Drogheda, relative to its size and potential, gets little attention from local and central government. Despite a Financial Times publication endorsing Drogheda.
Okay, hang on, Anna, don't read out a statement to me, please.
I'm not reading it out.
It sounds like.
No,
but just
to
go back now, sorry,
right,
well then.
Joe.
Okay, well done. You're very just, but let me ask you something else. You say the administration, the administrative centre of Louth is in Dundalk.
Dundalk and Navan.
But it has to be somewhere.
It has to, but we want it in the centre of Drogheda. The Drogheda would have its own administration.
And what difference would it make?
Well, it means it would be much, much better administered. Things would be happening. We have no... We've nobody fighting for us in Drogheda. We're left at the tail end of everything. The Gernon report was one of the main things that came into Drogheda. Minister McEntee asked that report be done. And since that report has been put in, the implementation board has been set up. And the guards and Martin O'Brien of the Loudmeath Education Board, they're doing great things for Drogheda. But that's going to finish at the end of this year. And we would like to see something set up following on from that, probably like a city manager or somebody that can control what's going on in Drogheda and Eastmeath. It's very important that this happens because people are losing heart when there's no construction within the town.
But you're saying that people are losing heart because Drogheda is not called a city.
No. It's the administration of it. And we feel that if it's made a city, that proper administration will come. It's not just to get the name of the city. It's to get the Drogheda area administered properly.
And why is it not being administered properly at the moment?
Because we're falling between two stools. We're falling between Dundalk and Navan. And Drogheda is the largest town in Ireland, and that's confirmed by the CSO.
Yeah, population in 2016 of 41,000.
Do you think it should be considered first for anything that's happened? It's an IDA job. It's black spot. We don't get any IDA jobs, and we've been fighting that for a long time.
You've only edged ahead of Dundalk relatively recently. Dundalk is, you're 41, Dundalk is 39. It's like the SNP leadership race is so close.
Yeah, but Dundalk's including Blackrock into that. We can't even include the people that's in Drogheda, but they're registered in Meath. So it needs a whole investigation into what's going on to get anything done for Drogheda.
Okay, but you're saying Drogheda, if there's city status to be handed out, Drogheda's next in line.
Oh, definitely. And I mean,
Galway City has doubled the population of Drogheda. You know what I mean? It is a big difference. Like Ballyfermot, where I'm from, is a population at one stage of over 40,000, more than Drogheda. That was never even designated a town, let alone a city.
Yeah, but the point is, Joe, Donnycarney, Laytown and Bettystown are agglomerating with Drogheda and becoming the one area now.
Okay.
And those people are using Drogheda as their town. And that comes to an average of 79,000 people. And it'll probably be another extra 20,000 in the next 2 or 3 years with all the houses that's been built. There's over 8,000 houses been built in Drogheda within the next 2 years. The Taoiseach and Minister O'Brien were down to turn the sod in one of the housing schemes a week or two ago. But, I mean, it's expanding in a very fast way, and I think we have to be prepared for it. We have to set up the infrastructure and everything that goes with
Well, you remember, I think everyone does, after this spate of horrific gangland crime in Drogheda, the government set up, there was a march, and the Taoiseach at the time, I think it was Leo Varadkar,
but he set up
They set up a committee, didn't they? As the former head of the probation.
That's the implementation board. Yes,
yeah.
That's what I said.
Did they recommend that Drogheda be designated a city?
Well, they're working with us on it. Some of the members of it.
Well, I read the summary of the report. Now, I didn't read it all. I didn't have time, but I read the summary of the report, and they didn't recommend that Drogheda be designated a city. It didn't come up.
Yeah, well, we can get them to recognise that. But that's not the problem. But the crime in Drogheda exists as it exists in other big urban centres. But the guards and we were under...
Yeah, under resourced,
and then a bigger town than Waterford.
And did the Garda authorities not address that?
They did address it, okay. Yes, they did. And it has been successful.
Okay, that's good to hear, thank God.
Yeah, that was the implementation board, and that's why we want that something to follow on from the implementation board. If we could get a city manager in place where the CEO is of the implementation board to look into what Drogheda's needs.
Yeah, okay, Niall.
We're lucky enough at the moment. Go on.
Okay, Niall, let me bring in Niall Cairns. Niall, good afternoon.
Okay.
Are you a member
good
of this?
Joe, how are you?
Good, thanks. Are you a member of the Drogheda City Status Group?
I am indeed, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a campaign. Go ahead, tell us. Why? Why should? What difference would it make?
I think it would make quite a number of differences. I think even reputationally alone, as you alluded to earlier about the outbreak of criminal activities in Drogheda in some time past, I mean, that wasn't great for Drogheda's reputation, needless to say. And it came about at the time because the town was poorly resourced. The local Gardaí did not have the numbers they required for the size of the population. Again, Anna made the comparison there of Dundalk, similar size to Drogheda, but it had a lot more guards than Drogheda had. And similarly, Waterford, if you take Waterford as an urban and rural area combined, their hinterland, Drogheda's urban and rural area
yeah, but
now
what's,
are and as
I,
big
I,
as.
I take that point, though, let's be clear now. Let's be clear. Yep. The Gardaí didn't implement the savage violence in Drogheda. Or the savage gangland killings in Drogheda. They didn't. They were done by named individuals. Some of them are behind bars. Some of them are not. One of them died recently. So designating Drogheda as a city wouldn't not have made a twitter of difference to that. I'm sure the criminals, and they are criminals.
Wouldn't
it bother them whether they were living in a town, city, a village, or a meeting hall or whatever. They are what they are, regardless of what the area is called. Calling Drogheda a city wouldn't have made a twitter of difference to those thugs.
No, but the difference, Joe, would be that if Drogheda had been a city at the time and had its own administration, the likelihood is that same administration would have impacted upon the local Garda service to try and ensure that they had the resources they required. Like, the Gardaí in Drogheda knew they were under-resourced. It was not their failing. The reality was they were kind of somewhat strapped for want of resources. Mm-hmm. And generally, when you aren't a city, you're seen and viewed in a different light. I mean, if take, for example, the likes of, say, inward investment for the likes of the IDA or tourism. When people are looking at an area to go to, a city will stand out more than a town. Like, we've six cities in Ireland at present. We've about, 30 or 40 towns. If you want to stand out among those, it's much easier when you have the title of a city. If you take, for example, the likes of, we'd say, Kilkenny, which is a city. Yeah. If you said to the people of Kilkenny, we're going to withdraw that status from you.
I know, I'm sure they'd be up in arms.
And there'd be good reason for it. So they understand the value of city status, whatever about others. And similarly, Sligo, which is not actually a city, but the local authority calls a city, and I commend them for it. They see the benefit of it too. So if Kilkenny and Sligo see the benefit, and if you take, we say, on the island of Ireland, you take Armagh and Uri, they're both cities too, both considerably smaller than Drogheda.
These
towns see the benefit of the city, so why should we not see the same benefit? And if we don't see that benefit, more fool us.
And I think in the UK, through some dispensation by the Queen or whatever, some royalist dispensation, she or he now can nominate, can designate, they did it recently, where the MP had been murdered and he had been campaigning for his area to be designated the city unsuccessfully, but they decided through the monarchy as a gesture to designate the city as part of his legacy, God rest him. I think in the UK there are different stipulations that go with being called a city, and they go back to the fact that they don't have a constitution. It goes back to the royalist monarchy
charters,
but charters. But Niall, are you trying to give Dundalk one in the eye?
Oh, no. Well, listen, like, Dundalk is a similar size to Drogheda. If they have similar ambitions, I'd wish them the best of luck too. You know, I mean, both of our towns have a business improvement district. By chance, I'm the chairman of the one in Drogheda. But, like, the one in Dundalk was established before the one in Drogheda. We followed suit. They've both been very successful.
Okay.
Loud County Council, to their credit, have been hugely supportive of both organisations. So we are deeply indebted to the council for that. But we just kind of feel the council don't fully buy into the notion of describing the town as a city. And I think we should. Mm-hmm. I think from a tourism point of view, it's much easier to market. And it costs little just to have the title, whatever about the administration that may come with that eventually. As I say, Sligo see the benefit of it. There's a reason they do. there are no fools in Sligo, I know. So I think we should follow suit. Our town is growing rapidly.
Leitrim and Mornington should be taken into consideration with Grosna.
Say again, Anna, sorry?
The agglomeration of Leitrim, Bettystown and
Mornington,
they're agglomerating with Drogheda, so their numbers would be included in the city.
Okay, and Niall, your name, Niall Kearns, is a very, very well-known name around Drogheda. I'm thinking of Jumbo, I'm thinking of the great journalists and various other people that have emerged. But what reaction do you get locally when you appeal to your local reps?
Well, funny enough, our local councillors agree with the position we've taken and have voted for it at our council meeting that the town should be referred to as a city. So that was passed by our councillors in the past. But it hasn't been followed through. And I'd love to see our executive follow suit and have a similar mindset and use the term of describing the town as a city. It doesn't have to cost millions. It doesn't mean that we have to put in a massive admin centre as of yet. But the time, I dare say, will eventually happen. Like, Drogheda's population is growing at 14.5%. We're expecting 8,000 houses to be built on the north side of town, and we've already had probably about 5,500 to 6,000 houses built on the south side of town. They expect the population on the north side of Drogheda to increase by 20,000 by the time the PANCR is completed, which is probably inside of the next 8 years. That's a large population, no matter what way you look at it. We are as big as Waterford as we speak now, and we will probably in the next census pass Waterford by way of the size of our population. And at that stage, then we'll be looking. Galway could be in our sights next.
Okay, well, let's hope all. And I was up in Drogheda recently, and I was struck even on the journey up and even on the way back, because I came through Bettystown and Laytown and Mornington. I was struck by the amount of house building and apartment building. It was phenomenal. Let's hope for the good. Let's hope.
There's a lot going
let's
on.
Hope, yeah, you can see that. But let's
Joe, people see the benefit of living in and near Drogheda. There's a reason they want to do it. And obviously part of it is that it's cheaper housing than in Dublin. And we understand that.
And
we want to cater for their needs. We want to have the education there for them. We want the jobs there for them.
And it's beautiful, beautiful location as well. Okay, let's hope all let's hope all those houses come on stream. They're being built. That's the main thing.
They're being built.
Let's hope they. Well, hopefully they won't come on stream before Wednesday with the government. But no. let's hope they come on stream. Okay, Niall Kearns and Anna McKenna. Best of luck on your Drogheda City Status Group campaign. Liam, good afternoon. The mobile homes as an answer. Are they eligible? I don't know the answer to that question. Yes, they are. They eligible to apply for the £800 from the government? Go ahead, Liam. Your point, please.
Yeah, of course they are, Joe. They're perfectly suitable.
But are you answering my question? Are they eligible? I'm trying to find out. Are they
are eligible. They are.
Oh, are they great? Why? Have you researched that?
Oh, no. I thought you meant were they suitable. Sorry. But they are suitable. And as regards eligible, that's a matter for the politicians. And,
well, it's a matter for the department.
They should confer with one another, perhaps confer with the country people instead of, being up there looking at one another. What will we do? The thing is that half of Ireland in the country years ago were reared in mobile homes, and I don't see any of them come out any the worse off for it. And they were perfectly suitable. And
But mobile homes have improved dramatically in the last 20 years, haven't they? The standard of them.
Oh, absolutely.
Central heating, electric fires, Wi-Fi, air fryers, decks.
Yeah.
Grey heating indoors and outdoor, very, very, very comfortable. A lot of them have a shed with a dryer, a washing machine and a fridge freezer. So they're great. Orlet, but there is another side to it. Orlet, good afternoon. You're currently living in a mobile home. Go ahead, Orlet.
Hi, Joe. It's lovely to speak to you.
Likewise.
I'm currently living in a mobile home. Me and my partner have done about 3 winters in it now.
Okay. And where is it, Arlen?
It's in Leash, and it's in some of my parents' property.
Okay.
So it's not ideal. It hasn't been.
It's not by choice.
Not by choice. It was out of desperation, out of needing somewhere to live during COVID, and you know we've done over 3 winters now, and like we had to put a lot of work into it to even do it up.
Okay. And did you buy it new or?
No, we bought it for about 11,000. It was imported from the UK.
Okay.
Pre-Brexit, obviously, so it's probably more expensive now. And we've had to put a lot of work into it, even though it comes with a winter pack. So we had a stove put into it. We lined it with insulation ourselves. And I suppose my point was just, Joe, like that, like a lot of people are already living in mobile homes out of desperation, like young people, I suppose. And yeah. I'd lived abroad for about 14 years and was really excited about coming back to Ireland. And I love Ireland a lot, but we're going to emigrate again at the end of this year you just can't move forward, you know, because we can't stay living in a mobile home.
Yeah, but have you any chance of getting planning permission to build where the mobile home is?
Yeah, we probably could, but we don't really want to commit to building. Maybe it's just a fear of commitment, but we're not ready to do that yet. Like, we'd like to maybe live in some other parts of Ireland or experience that, but it's just not really an option, obviously. So we're off back to Australia. That's the plan.
And you lived in it for 3 winters. Obviously refugees won't necessarily stay here. They're talking about, and the phrase used in the government scheme is temporary accommodation. What was it like living in it, say, for 6 months?
I think if you were in it, like, the toughest months are mainly from kind of October, November till just coming up to the end of March. That's the toughest, you know, and obviously because you end up with a lot of condensation and water inside, which can cause mould and damp. The main issue.
And how modern, what facilities did your mobile home have?
We've got like a shower, we've got obviously running water, we've got gas. We put in a wood burning stove so that we're not relying on gas all the time. It's fine. I mean, it's 40 meters square. That's as good as some apartments I've lived in London. You know, but it's me and my partner and our 2 pets. But if you want to, I think it's not forever. It's okay as a little stopgap.
I know that you're heading back to Australia. Okay, and you're doing that. Why?
Why? Because. Somewhere to live, Joe. You know, like, and it's crazy. I work in architecture and I'm constantly helping clients, build new houses. But I can't do my own. So, we've got to go, unfortunately.
Okay.
Yeah.
Safe traveling, and I hope you
come back.
I hope your wishes, if they are to come back, that they come through very soon. Okay, Earl, I'd appreciate it. Thanks indeed for your call. Nadine Maloney produced, and Ray Darcy's next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.